For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and I'm talking to you from my broom cupboard.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, once again in the bedroom, and coming up on today's show.
Sarah Morgan introduces us to her new novel, Family for Beginners.
Al Petrie and Lucy Scott discuss acting in a theatre for one at the RNIB Talking Books Library.
We've got more Cabin Fever fables from Staraband Books.
And some great book recommendations in Books of Your Life. That's all coming up in today's show. Now, before we start, Red, did I get Alistair's name right?
Well, he said to me that in Hollywood and down south, he's known as Petrie, but to his Scottish relations, he's known as Petrie. So I guess since you're up in Ayrshire, you did.
And I didn't know he had quite a big role in Rogue One. He's the leader of the Rebel Alliance. I'm quite excited about this one. But coming up next, we've got Sarah Morgan.
Sarah Morgan's books have been called comfort reading at its best. And her new novel, Family for Beginners, should be the perfect tonic for anybody struggling with living in close proximity to their nearest and dearest. Here she is to tell us more about it and her life as an author. Sarah Morgan, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Transport us away from lockdown to your latest novel.
Gosh, yes. Well, I'm very happy to be transported away from lockdown. If there's one place I could go immediately after lockdown, it would be the Lake District. And that's where my novel is set. So I feel like rereading it myself at the moment, actually. I write relationship novels, really. And I wanted to write a sort of complicated romantic relationship and also a complicated friendship. And in Family for Beginners, my heroine falls in love with Jack, which is lovely. But Jack is a widower who has two daughters, including a slightly difficult teenager, Izzy, who certainly doesn't want a replacement mother. So Flora has to navigate very choppy waters. And then Jack invites her to join them on their summer holiday with his dead wife's best friend, which is something that they've always done every year. And he wants the children to have the same routine and not disrupt anything. But it means that Flora is then facing the challenge of her life because she's trying so hard to fit in and be what she thinks they need her to be. And she's sort of losing sight of who she really is. So it's a sort of complicated relationship and also an exploration of complicated friendship, but it's upbeat as well, lots and lots of humour, and as I said, a beautiful setting. It's set in the Lake District, which is one of my favourite places, so many happy family memories for me. So yes, it was a joy to write. I do like to set novels in places I'd like to be, because obviously I'm there while I'm writing it in my head, so I like it to be somewhere that I'd really like to be in person.
And that really comes through in your rich descriptions of the landscape, the natural beauty of the Lake District. And it was like stepping outside of my house and going back to a place that I've enjoyed myself.
Yes, lovely. It's a wonderful spot, isn't it? A wonderful spot. I think it's just unbeatable, really. And I've been fortunate enough to go to many places, but I can't think of anywhere more beautiful.
The relationship tension amongst people who all fundamentally love each other but irritate each other because of the artificiality of the situation that they find themselves in is perfect for these times.
Indeed. Trapped together. That's what this book is, really. They're all trapped together by the lake and they're all trying to do their very best and contorting themselves into different shapes to please the other people. And it just becomes a bit exhausting after a while. And your own personality has to occasionally burst through. So that does bring some moments of humour and tension. But yes, you're right. Particularly appropriate for the current times.
Well, as you say, it's very funny and it's also very hopeful as well, that out of tragedy people can forge new and loving relationships if they just take a little bit of time to step back and meet people halfway.
I hope, my books are always hopeful. I always do say, even now, you know, readers, a reader said to me the other day, I'm loving this book, but I am wondering, will it end happily? And I said, my books always end happily. That's 100% guaranteed. It is a hopeful book because I think I'm a very hopeful person, really. And none of us know what's coming round the corner. But I think all you can do is keep putting yourself out there and doing the very best you can, which is what my heroine is doing, you know, because I suppose every relationship requires a degree of bravery. And it does require you to put yourself out there. That's what my hero is doing. But it's also what my heroine's doing, because she's always longed for a close family relationship and she wants that very badly. So she's sort of contorting herself in order to try and fit in. But yes, it is very hopeful. It is hopeful. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we won't always be locked in our houses, Red.
Yes. You also reminded me that having a flouncy teenager is perfectly normal.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. And I think, you know, I hope that one thing my books do is reflect real life. I think people, in fact, I know they do, because I have people writing to me saying, gosh, you know, I really identified with that particular story. Or I have people saying that a particular story helped them see things in a different way. So I hope that there is a real element of reality and reflection of real life in it. Though, of course, everybody is individual and the way they handle things, the choices they make are all individual. But yeah, my books are hopeful and yes, real.
We're lucky enough to have a wide selection of your books as talking books in the RNIB library. But then I went off and did my research and you've written over 80 books, which is staggering.
Yes, my publisher tells me actually that I have now hit 90, and I have to say I didn't realise that. I gave up counting a while ago. But, you know, I have been doing this for a long time and I started off writing medical romance many years ago. I used to be a nurse and that was my entry into writing, the medical romance. So I wrote about 35 of those before I moved on to other things. I wrote those for Mills and Boone and they were great fun. I really enjoyed them and lots of my readers still read them and love them now. And in fact, funnily enough, many of those were set in the Lake District. I used to do a series that was related to mountain rescue and set in the lake. So it's not the first time that I've gone back there, although it is the first time in one of my longer novels. So yes, 90 books apparently. That's a lot of work. No wonder I'm tired. I'm just kidding. I love it.
I was working out that that's about 4 a year, isn't it?
Yeah, well, with the shorter Mills and Boone books, I was writing 4 to 6. When I started writing the longer books, things like my Manhattan series and the Sleigh Bells in the Snow, I was writing 3 of those a year. And now I'm writing the longer novels that are more complicated. They've got more threads, bigger issues, more characters. Then I'm writing 2 of those a year, Christmas and a summer. I love writing both seasons. I would not be able to give one up, but Christmas has always been a particularly special time to me. I love writing Christmas books. I've written one every year since I was published. So that's, I don't even want to add that up, to be honest, Rob, but it's a lot. So now it's 2 a year, but there have been years when I was writing shorter books when there were, yeah, when I did up to 6.
And do you treat the Christmas and the summer books as different disciplines? Is there a template that differs?
Oh, what an excellent question. No, I mean, at the heart of it, it's still an emotional relationship story. But I would say that the Christmas book does indeed have different elements. There are some things I think when a reader picks up a Christmas book, and I know this because I am one, I'm a reader as well as the writer, you want certain elements. You want the elements, I suppose, we all dream about with our fantasy Christmas. So you want this fluffy snow. In real life, your heart may sink because you really don't want to be scraping ice off your car at 6 in the morning and you don't want to be driving on dangerous roads or anything like that. You don't want to be cold in your home. But in between the pages of a book, Christmas can be magical. And the other thing about Christmas, of course, is that it does, in normal circumstances where we're not in lockdown, Christmas is a time when family does come together. So in fact, that's very much often a lockdown theme that you're exploring, actually, now I think about it. My upcoming Christmas book that I've just finished, which will be out this year, is about a family. Their mother joins them. They've been estranged, and the mother suddenly decides that she wants to fix this and join them for Christmas. So you're often trapped with people at Christmas that you perhaps wouldn't necessarily choose to be. And that, for a writer, of course, opens up no end of juicy possibilities for exploring human tension. So I wouldn't say it's a different template at all, but it does have to offer a certain magical feeling that perhaps you don't reflect in the summer book. Well, you do it in a different way. In the summer, I'm trying to make people feel vicariously as if they've been on a lovely summer holiday and they've had that lovely feeling of the sun on their skin and the warmth of the sun and that kind of thing. Feel the water on their toes. But in the winter, it's a very different type of atmosphere that you're trying to create. And I think that atmosphere is key, really.
I suppose there are a lot more outdoor scenes in a summer book, whereas yes. you're indoors more in the winter books, next to a fire or whatever.
Exactly.
Do you write off season? So are you writing the Christmas book in the summer?
I would say I write about half the book off season. So I start my Christmas book in around October. So for 3 months, I'm thinking Christmas at the right time of year. I start earlier than most people, but then I don't usually completely finish it until February or March. So my tree stays up. I mean, not my real tree, because obviously that would just be twigs, but I have a fake tree that I keep because I have to keep myself in the mood. You know, everybody else has gone off the boil and they're thinking Valentine's Day and looking towards Easter, and I'm still trying to stay in the Christmas mood. So yes, I have to write Christmas in January, February, March. And my summer book, I usually do start around March when I turn in the Christmas one. So yes, I'm thinking summer while I've still got my heating on and I'm wearing woolly jumpers to write in, fingerless gloves, but then I do get into summer. So again, I reckon about half the book I write is in the right season, and then I have to stretch that out by the use of my imagination.
And you mentioned the series of mountain rescue books that you've written in the past and that you were a nurse. The NHS is at the forefront of all our minds at the moment.
Indeed.
Do you miss that time as a nurse? Did you consider perhaps going back and volunteering for the NHS?
Oh, I'm way too far for that. No one would want me. I haven't been a nurse for a couple of decades now. I've been lucky enough to be writing for over 20 years, so nobody would want me by their bedside. Do I miss it? I certainly miss the interaction and the caring side of it, but I still get that from my writing. I've got wonderful readers who communicate with me frequently, and they'll often say, you know, I was up all night with my really sick father and your book really helped me. And I kind of feel like, in a funny sort of way, it's still a type of caring. It's difficult to explain. When I was a nurse, I think one of the things that I learned is that you cannot fix everything for everyone. You would really like to, but you can't. But the one thing that you can do is perhaps make a moment better. So as a nurse, you might be trying to make someone more comfortable or reading to them or holding their hand, just something to make that moment better. And I think as a writer, you're doing that too, because I can't fix lockdown for people now. But I can give them a book that might make an hour or two of lockdown go a bit faster, or, you know, if they're going through a really difficult time with somebody in their family affected or ill, perhaps I can give them an hour where their mind is taken off it. And I think that's the same sort of principle. I don't miss the frontline clinical stuff because it's been a long time since I've done that, but I miss the interaction. But I still try and have that with my readers. I've got a very good interactive relationship with my readers. I'm very lucky like that.
And you're hugely popular with the RNIB library readers.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that.
We have wonderful talking book versions of so many of your books. You must be delighted that the audiobooks are reaching an audience who wouldn't otherwise be able to access your stories.
Yes, oh, very much so. I love audiobooks myself. It's like being read to. So yes, I'm thrilled to see that that side is really, really growing. And it's growing in a lot of countries, isn't it?
And it's also growing at the moment where none of the bookshops are open.
Indeed.
Do you have much to do with the selection of narrators for your audiobooks?
Yes, they do usually send me a selection. Because a lot of my books are a mixture of British and American characters, we have to try and get a narrator who can handle both accents. So I will listen to a few that they send me and send my preference. But generally, I'm really lucky with who they've chosen to read the books. I mean, you know, that for me, when I'm choosing a book, the narrator is incredibly important. If you don't think you're going to be able to listen to that voice for the duration of the story, then that will turn you off, no matter how much you want to actually listen to the book. Do you not find the same?
Yes. And I also wonder with authors, now that you know that your book is going to be made into an audiobook, whether that also changes the way that you write.
Oh, that's a very good question. I haven't been asked that before. It doesn't, but that may be because when I write, one of the things that I do when I reach the final editing process, when I have a full manuscript, is to read it aloud. So to some extent, I'm doing exactly what you're just saying, although I hadn't actually identified it as that. I'm not really thinking, how is this going to sound when it's read out? But I am testing how it sounds when it's read out, because that's a really excellent way of spotting mistakes, checking rhythm and whether your dialogue sounds authentic. And I actually read it out in an audio type voice to try and see how it sounds. But that isn't because I'm thinking, how will this be for an audio reader? It's because I'm testing the strength of the story. But that's really interesting. Yes, I mean, it will also obviously tell me how it's going to be for an audio reader, now I think about it.
We will leave with a clip of Family for Beginners, narrated by Catherine Fenton. And Sarah Morgan, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and for giving us a glimpse into your life as an author.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
The first time she saw him, he was standing outside the store, staring at the flowers in the window. His hands were thrust into the pockets of his coat, the collar turned up against the savage bite of a New York winter. It was the type of raw, freezing day that turned each breath into a white, puffy cloud, the sky moody and heavy with menace. People scurried past, heads down, going about their business with grim determination. Not this man. He didn't push open the door and seek refuge from the cold, as so many had done before him that morning. Instead, he lingered, a blank expression on his face as he scanned the array of blooms that splashed color over the monochrome of winter. Gilt flowers. Julia plucked 12 long-stemmed roses from the bucket and placed them on the workstation. He's going to buy gilt flowers. I bet you $10 he's had an affair, and he's looking at those flowers trying to figure out which of them says sorry in a way that isn't going to get him kicked out of the house. Flora didn't take the bet. And not only because she knew Julia didn't have $10 to throw away.
Family for Beginners, narrated by Catherine Fenton and written by Sarah Morgan, is available as TB705359, where it joins a wide selection of other novels by Sarah Morgan in the RNIB library. And Sarah will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now here with everything from Star Wars to the mystery of the pantomime cat, here's Al Petrie and Lucy Scott.
RNIB has launched a new online library, offering blind and partially sighted people free access to thousands of titles in formats they can read. It's funded by voluntary donations, and with lockdown restricting outdoor activity, the window that books provide onto other worlds has never been so important. The Talking Book Studios have always employed actors to bring titles to life, many of whom feel passionate about the work that they do. Husband and wife team Alistair Petrie and Lucy Scott are no exception. They're stars of stage and screen and keen supporters of the RNIB Library.
Lucy Scott and Alistair Petrie, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, I understand that you've been busily promoting our new RNIB online library.
Yeah, it's such an amazing resource. What's really struck me recently with the circumstances we find ourselves in is the access and the need that we really have at the moment for stories. And I've thought a lot about this over the last sort of few weeks, that, you know, it's a confusing time, this whole sort of COVID-19 that everyone is going through. And having access to stories and a plentiful amount of stories is also very important, stories being so crucial to our lives. And how stories sort of help us understand the world in which we live, to make sense of the world in which we live. And I think we could all argue quite merrily at the moment that the world in which we find ourselves living is so extraordinary and so confusing, and there's a lot coming at us. And I think it gives us huge amounts of comfort as well. It gives us time away from our own thought processes, which is, I think, incredibly healthy. It feeds into our imaginations, and all of these things are in existence throughout our normal lives and in our very abnormal lives, which we're finding ourselves at the moment. It's never been more important. that access to stories.
One of the books that I've gone back to, which actually you narrated, is Touching the Void by Joe Simpson, which tells the story of his horrendous climbing accident and how he survived it. A chapter that really resonated with me was Set Achievable Targets, which has reminded me that we need to think of lockdown on a day-to-day basis rather than, oh, this could go on for months.
I think that's exactly right. I think if you try and see it and understand it as a whole, one is doomed to failure. I think accepting it day by day, trying to disseminate information, not to get too overwhelmed by that information, is so true. What's so extraordinary about that book, and a lot of books that I've always been rather attracted to when I've read them and or narrated them, is these human tales of endeavor and sort of how the human psyche works in those terms. And I think it's absolutely distilling it down to bite-sized chunks. And I've said this to my son several times when it comes to simple things in terms of their GCSE period last year, the 6 weeks of that. If you try and see it as a whole, then it'll become overwhelming and emotionally overwhelming. So yes, break it down into its constituent parts. And if you can do that, you can sort of navigate a way through it. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that is a really useful and applicable comparison to where we find ourselves in the world at the moment. Very much so.
Now, you've read a few dozen titles in the RNIB Talking Books library. However, Lucy Scott, you have read over 100, I found out.
Maybe not at all. I've read many more than that. Yes, I've been reading for the RNIB for over 20 years. I love it. I love going there. And I've learned so much from reading with you. My very first book was a children's book, and you were based at Great Portland Street. That's where the studios were. And I remember having prepared it, and I got very excited about it, and I bowled in there with all these explosions of accents and massive colour, and it was just too much. And one of the engineers, he was called Peter, he said, oh, you need to just wind that in, just dial it back, because it's just too much. It all becomes a story about accents. Just forget it. You need to give little flavours and allow the story to take over. And that was a really important lesson. Hand the story over and don't sort of cover it in all of your ego.
There was an upside to that, though. I remember when Lucy started reading for the RNIB and the enthusiasm with which Lucy came home, which is a wonderfully default position for Lucy, but she came home and was talking all about it, not only the sort of skills required and the sort of creative endeavour that was reading, but also the atmosphere working alongside the RNIB at the studios was so uplifting that she said, you've got to get involved. So I was very lucky that I think Lucy sort of nudged and cajoled various people into saying, well, would you listen to his voice and see if it might be appropriate for you? So it's entirely thanks to Lucy that I ever started to build a relationship with the RNIB. And for that, I'm eternally grateful, amongst many other things.
And Lucy, what was it that led you to the RNIB in the first place?
I love listening to audiobooks myself. And I happened to meet somebody who read for the RNIB. So I practically bit her hand off and said, oh, please, I'd love to do that too. It's something, I mean, as a child, I've always loved lying on the floor and listening to somebody read to me. That's one of my first memories, is my mum reading me Norse mythology tales when we were out on some walk up in Scotland. Really, really evocative. So a personal love of audio.
Now, when I was looking through the many, many books that you've narrated, one of them is actually the first book that I remember my mum reading to me, The Mystery of the Pantomime Cat by Enid Blyton. It's exactly that it conjures up that safety and security of somebody telling you a story.
Yes, I think that's what it is. It's like a blanket. It's like a duvet. It's just so wonderful. It's a theatre for one. So your imagination just is released. Somebody else is feeding you the information and you're just off on a little journey. It's just wonderful.
Gosh, I nearly sneezed then, whispered Larry. Come on, I'm frozen.
They went quietly home, Larry to tell Daisy, his sister, that they had found a good place to hide the next night, and Fatty to plan their disguises. He pulled out some old clothes and looked at them. Aha! PC Pippin, he thought, there's a nice little surprise being planned for you.
Have you managed to record at all since the lockdown?
I have. In fact, we set up, it looks like a five-year-old's den made out of mattresses and blankets and rugs in a spare room with a nice mic. And we've been crawling into this little den and actually recording. I recorded something for the RNIB, The Umbrella Mouse, set in the Second World War, where one of the engineers, Pinky, I'd sent him all my raw audio and he would clean it up his end. And Al's also recorded a play, a Big Finish.
Yeah, a Doctor Who play, which was really fun. And hopefully this lockdown won't go on for a huge while longer and we can get back to doing what we do best and where we do it best at.
So we do feel lucky that we
Yeah, we do. We have the capacity to do it. And thanks to Lucy's technical skills and my ability to point at things, the studio, sort of home-based studio, has been created. So we are very much up and running and we'd dearly, as ever, love to do more. But there's no substitute for going in to record on site in studio. It feeds more into the work in many ways. And I think in life we look for community. And I think that's exactly what the RNIB offers. It's the strength of community. And that's not only people that access the service, but the people that sort of contribute to the Talking Book service as well. It's all part of the same community.
But it's wonderful to know that that community spirit is all pulling together to ensure that books are still being recorded, to ensure that we do still manage to get programmes out on the radio station. And of course, the new RNIB Online Reading Services Library has just been launched, which means that people no longer need to receive things through the letterbox. They can just download them immediately onto their phones and their computers and listen to, well, you, Lucy, reading Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen.
Hooray! Yeah. That's so wonderful to hear from our end.
That's good news.
That's so good to hear.
I think the technical aspect is so important, the immediacy of people able to just sort of click and collect and not have to wait is just fantastic. So access is key, and the more access the better. And now sort of immediately downloadable, you can have a thought in your head, I want to listen to that. Is it available? Yes, it is. I can start in 30 seconds, and that is just wonderful.
From all those books that you've both narrated, do you both have favourites that have really stuck with you?
It's not particularly a favourite, but it's one that's really memorable, is when Al and I recorded something together, and it was the entire Guinness World Records book. We read it cover to cover. He read one new record, I read the next new record, and it took us about a week.
Discover the largest populations on the planet, where elbow room comes at a premium.
City, Tokyo, Japan. 36 million people, making Greater Tokyo home to 28% of Japan's 126.8 million citizens.
Island, Java, Indonesia. 136 million people, or an incredible 57% of the Indonesian population.
Country, China. 1.330 billion people, ahead of India's 1.148 billion and the USA's 303.8 million.
Continent, Asia. 4 billion people, thanks largely to Chinese and Indian contributions.
What was so memorable about it in many ways was that we sort of went through an entire spectrum of being totally awestruck at certain human achievements, to be massively irritated by
one man
who decided to gain as many world records as he could. Well, create a world record that really didn't need creating. So how many baked beans could you balance on a cocktail stick? Yes.
Running 100 metres in a pair of fins.
Yeah, I think he carries, I don't know, a few dozen. And instead of going, well done, as we touched on earlier, the idea of the human spirit and endeavour, it was just deeply irritating. But good luck to him, why not? I'm sure he's going to come up with a lot more, given that he's got a lot of time on his hands. But I think personally, that there were sort of two, really. And again, it touches on what we talked about earlier, which is the sense of adventure and the human spirit. The first one, which I was very touched by for a variety of reasons, was Blood and Sand, the Frank Gardner book, the BBC security correspondent who was shot in Saudi Arabia. And I've never forgotten it, partly because as a child I was brought up in Saudi Arabia, so it was sort of quite a key part of my growing up, and this was sort of the late 70s. I knew the story, obviously, of what happened to Frank Gardner, because he's now obviously in a wheelchair as a result of his injuries. The fact that he survived was pretty remarkable. But I've never forgotten reading a section in the book where he talked about how he always carried a small Quran in his back pocket. He was a man who grew up himself in the Middle East and had an inherent understanding of it. And what really his passion was to try and convey what was going on in the Middle East to a Western audience. And so he had a great empathy and an understanding of that region. And yet he was shot. And when he had been shot, he was desperately trying to get access to this Quran in the back of his pocket so he could basically pull it out as a mark of just trying to sort of demonstrate that he wasn't the enemy. And Touching the Void, as you mentioned, I do love those stories of very serious human endeavor, but also the lighthearted notion as well. I guess maybe I should have been a tepid explorer in a past life, although I hate camping, so that probably wouldn't have worked.
I really enjoy multi-voice reads. There was a lovely Jacqueline Wilson book called Twins, and I read it with Rachel Atkins, and it just makes it so enlivening having somebody else read it with you. Also, something I really did enjoy was Mr. Pip by Lloyd Jones, who's I think he's a New Zealand journalist, but it was a piece of fiction set in Papua New Guinea during a civil war. And it was from the point of view of a young girl. The whole educational structure, well, the whole infrastructure had collapsed. And the only person that remained on the island to teach them was this old guy who had, I think his wife wasn't very well. And the only thing that he could teach them was about Great Expectations. So she, within the book, disappeared off into another book, which was Victorian England. And that sort of took her away from the horrors of where she was in Papua New Guinea. It's a beautiful book. I think they made it into a film with Hugh Laurie. Anyway, really, really lovely. The only trouble is, if you're reading in the first person, you think, how am I going to read this young girl? Should I read her with an accent? Or I started off reading her with an accent, and then I started realizing that it was impossible. So after 50 pages, I had to start all over again.
that's the classic narrator's terror.
Oh, my goodness.
If you don't prepare, you can...
Because I really wanted to get it right. I wanted to do a really good job, and I realized I was doing a terrible job.
You've mentioned that you've worked once together before on the Guinness Book of World Records. Is there a book that you would push all the other narrators out of the way to narrate together?
Yes, gosh, there's one I would love to do with Lucy. I think it feeds into the thing that Lucy mentioned about sort of multi-voices, really, is His Dark Materials, the Philip Pullman trilogy. There's obviously lots to get into. It's three vast and wonderful books. But I did that as a stage production at the National Theatre about, 15, 16 years ago. But I think it would be an amazing journey to take with Lucy through the worlds and the existences that the characters go through. I would love to do something epic like that. We did spend a week doing the Guinness Book of World Records, and we didn't fall out.
No, we still smiled at each other.
we were across a table as well, so it was a sort of a unique working method as well. We sort of sat opposite each other. That was really, really enjoyable working together on that.
And Lucy, is there a book that you've got your eye on?
I do love books with dialogue and character. I mean, Jane Austen writes such beautiful characters, and I do love them, and I'd always love to revisit, and there's some beautiful characters in there.
I think Dickens as well would be amazing, yeah, to dive into the structure of Dickens' storytelling. Obviously, the vast array of characters, a lot of them very heightened characters as well, so one could really play with those. I think we would have a ball. In fact, I'm sure whoever was producing and engineering the book would be constantly telling us to calm down, which is always tricky to do with actors. But so classics, really.
Although Al once read a book about the story of Queen Anne. Anyway, he had one scene where he had a conversation.
Oh, yeah. Lady Jane.
Lady Jane, yeah. Grey, that's it. And he had a conversation that he had to have with himself, effectively, where one of the characters was from the West Country and another character was from North Norfolk. And that was almost an impossibility.
It was the ultimate challenge. if you call it the climbing of Mount Everest for a narrator, I think that may have been it. Getting lost in a snowstorm of accents in the death zone, that's where I got.
So Star Wars is easy in comparison to working for the RNIB Talking Book Studios, then?
Star Wars is comparatively easy. Yes, I'd much rather try and save the Rebel Alliance rather than have a conversation between someone from North Norfolk and someone from the West Country. Yeah, saving the galaxy 10 times easier.
Well, you heard it here first on RNIB Connect Radio. Well, Lucy Scott and Alistair Petrie, thank you so much for talking to the Read On listeners.
Such a pleasure. And I just wanted to highlight one thing that Lucy said that really struck me, and it's a phrase I haven't heard before, and maybe I probably should have done. The glory of the RNIB Talking Book Service is that it really does offer a theatre for one. I think that's a really wonderful description of what the service can offer. It's way more than just reading a book, and it is such a pleasure to do. So thank you, RNIB.
Yes, thank you so much for including us.
Well, I look forward to seeing you both back in the green room at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden when all this gets back to normal. But in the meanwhile, thank you so much for all the hard work that you've done in bringing books to life for people like me who can't read print anymore, and for coming onto the show to talk about your life in talking books.
A very big pleasure, Red. Thank you.
A complete pleasure, Red.
Thanks again to Lucy and Alistair. For a full list of the many titles that they've narrated, and for more information about the RNIB Reading Services Library, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. And now,
Saraband Books are an independent publisher in Scotland. And during this time of social distancing and self-isolation, they say that cabin fever is real. But Saraband don't want anyone to feel scared or alone, so they started a podcast. A place to share stories, spread calm, and have a laugh.
Hello, and welcome to Cabin Fever Fables. I'm Sarah Hunt from indie publisher Saraband, and this is episode 4. Each day, we're challenging an author to read an extract from their book that is in some way selected for its relevance to an aspect of coronavirus life. Whether it's on mental health, family, living in a small space, learning how great our local community is, or anything the author thinks is brought to the fore in our strange new world, we're hoping to provide a bit of an escape and a conversation if we can. You may have noticed that so far all our guests have been Scottish. Today we're featuring a northerner, Marion Dunn. Since we're now in lockdown, it seems a good moment to deploy someone who was very recently described by Woman's Hour's Jane Garvey as one of the most positive people she's ever met. When Marion was turning 50 a few years ago, she was worried about her declining fitness levels. She wasn't in the market for personal trainers and expensive memberships, but she found her way almost by accident to a local boxing gym. Very quickly, Marion was hooked. Not only did she find the atmosphere friendly and welcoming, but the training brought quick results in energy levels, endorphins, and a magnificent sense of stress busting. It would be some time before she had her first go in the ring, but when she tried sparring, it took every ounce of her strength and focus, and soon after, the resulting hunger pangs had her grasping at whatever could be found to eat.
I am placed in the boxing ring with a much more experienced male boxer for 5 3-minute rounds. My sole purpose is to try and break down his defences and to see if I can score any points against him at all. I consider myself to be quite fit now, but rather cruelly, I am not allowed to rest between the rounds. Instead, I am given a series of exercises, including fast step-ups on a bench to keep me occupied. Apparently, this keeps the necessary blood pumping round the muscles between the rounds. My opponent is not throwing any punches at all at me, but even without this obvious distraction, it is completely exhausting work. Because he is an experienced strategist, somehow he was making me do all the work. I seem to be whirling round and round the edge of the ring, feebly throwing punches into the air. He can read me like an open book, and merely ducks, slips, or rolls out of the way of my clunky jabs. Something must change, I think, as the bell rings and rings and the fourth round starts. For the first time ever, I actually start to engage my boxing brain. I must try something new or face complete humiliation in the eyes of the few onlookers. I feint a right-hand shot. This causes him to momentarily drop his guard, and I plant a good left hook. I drop down towards the floor by flexing my knees. He doesn't know what's going on, and this temporarily confuses him. I move forward in a display of pretend confidence. He moves back onto the ropes, and I deliver a couple of good body shots. Then I'm spent. The bell rings. At least I've managed something. The fifth round passes in a blur of exhaustion without event, but I do manage to deliver punches right to the last. I thank my opponent, and we fist bump gloves in the time-honoured way. He takes off his headgear and smiles. He has barely broken into a sweat, but I am all in. After getting changed, I have the immediate and quite primal desire to eat. It is an overpowering sense of hunger I have rarely experienced. Fortunately, I have a couple of cereal bars in the car. Feeling faint, I wolf these down. Perhaps these will stifle the hunger pangs before I can reach my favourite cafe in Rivington Village, a couple of miles away. After driving only 1 mile along the Bolton Ring Road, I turn off into a small car park. God help me! I have to eat again, right now! I fumble in a rucksack in the boot of my car, and thankfully find a few soggy glucose tablets right at the very bottom. Simultaneously, I glug down a whole flask of sugar-rich coffee. Then I feel as high as a kite, as my system is simultaneously swamped with endorphins, sugar and caffeine. It is the most glorious feeling imaginable. It makes me wonder what real boxers must feel like after a real match. Eventually, I make it to the Rivington Cafe. It is an old, slightly damp, churchy building stuffed with wet dogs and their rather earnest owners out for weekend walks on the Bolton Fells. Years ago, I recall that my partner shamed me in this cafe by asking for Eccles cakes. They're Chorley cakes round here, love, came the swift reply. I asked for beans on toast with scrambled eggs. Pray, pray, pray for it to be quick. I'm thirsty again and ask for a pint of tea loaded with sugar, then another one, then another one. It might be the road to diabetes hell, but I need it right now. I sink into a dreamy torpor. I am tired, but also alert and incredibly elated. The food revives me enough to make it back home by tea time. I wonder if I will ever replenish my reserves of energy. The following day, I lie languidly on the sofa and eat three enormous meals, one after the other, one of which is just a giant pan of spaghetti. You're never going to eat all that, my partner says aghast. I know it is slightly disgusting, but I just stuff it straight in, gratefully all the same. I'm still ravenous. After all, I lie. I'm allowed. I'm a boxer.
Thank you, Marion. It's only episode 4 and we've already managed to shoehorn in a mention of Eccles cakes. Well, let's get straight to our 4 corona questions. You're in isolation. You're at home. What are you reading to pass the time?
So, to pass the time, I'd love to tell you I'm reading some great literary work, but actually, it wouldn't be the truth. Instead, I'm reading some beautiful prose written by two geologists in 1924. The book's entitled The Geology of Yorkshire, and the two geologists are Percy Fry Kendall and Herbert E. Root. The thing that makes their book interesting is it's a geological field guide to Yorkshire, but written from the perspective of a railway carriage window. So clearly in those days we had a great network of railways, and it was possible to do such a thing.
What are you cooking tonight? I'm assuming it's probably something from your store cupboard.
What am I actually going to cook tonight from my store cupboard? Well, it kind of presupposes that I have a store cupboard, which I don't actually. That sounds rather organised. I think the likelihood is it's probably going to be beans on toast again. My cat, on the other hand, is dining magnificently. So over the last couple of days, he has had Pacific Lionsgate salmon, which he's enjoyed very much. But as I'm a vegetarian, that's out of bounds.
Who would you choose to dine with tonight if we were not all self-isolating?
So my preferred dining companions, there are so many to choose from, but I think my two favourites would be Andrew Graham Dixon, the art critic, and Muhammad Ali, who needs no introduction at all. Art is a mysterious language to me and one that I don't understand and don't feel able to explore on my own. But Andrew Graham Dixon's encyclopedic knowledge would help me understand, for example, what a grey wall with black splodges on it actually meant. And furthermore, I do actually trust him to give me sensible advice. So he would be dining companion number one. Number two would definitely be Muhammad Ali. As a not very good amateur boxer, Ali is right at the other end of the spectrum. And perhaps before we've eaten too much, he could try and teach me his famous boxing manoeuvre, the Ali Shuffle. I suspect that Andrew Graham Dixon and Ali ate rather magnificently, and I'm not sure how happy they'd be with beans on toast. So they might find themselves dining with a cat.
What's the most idiotic or funny or noteworthy bit of corona advice or official tip or corona behaviour that you've seen today?
So during the coronavirus outbreak, we've been given lots of conflicting advice and it's been rather difficult to make sense of. But one of the things that seems to be a constant is the magnificent sense of community spirit that this has all invoked. So I live in quite a remote rural part of Yorkshire, and I was very touched to find that somebody who I don't even know had put a flyer through my door yesterday offering help. I think we need to do a lot more of this sort of thing. And after the coronavirus outbreak is over, I think we need to have a long, hard look at the way we do some things in life and possibly even reconfigure our way of doing things.
So true. Our community has been fantastic as well, with all kinds of practical help and morale boosting. On that note, a shout out to our local Eccles Community Choir, with a gold standard WhatsApp-based support group / comedy club. Marion mentioned that she lives in a small village. Her nearest town is Settle, gateway to the Yorkshire Dales, and home to the independent Limestone Books. Until a day or two ago, they were offering free local delivery via cycle courier. But the new lockdown rules means that's had to be suspended. They can still post out books, and owner Tanya will give you her recommendations for yourself or if you're buying a gift. Please support them, or look up your own local bookshop. Our indie publishing pals, Gally Beggar, started a thread on Twitter today, pulling together information about high street bookshops. But I see they've now passed the torch to Indie Bookshop UK, who have brought together a pretty comprehensive list. We'll tag them on Twitter. We've also started a Cabin Fever Fables daily bulletin, where we're bringing together various resources and we'll tag all our friends and people we've mentioned there. Now, I'm wondering what I would want to ask Andrew Graham Dixon or Muhammad Ali first, as well as quite intrigued by the geology of Yorkshire as seen from a railway carriage. But I am slightly distracted by thinking that maybe Marion's cat is currently the best-off creature in all the land. That's all for today's Cabin Fever Fables. If you want to join in with your stories or comments, you'll find us on Twitter, at Saraband Books.
Thanks very much to Sarah at Saraband Books. Their web address is saraband.net, that's S-A-R-A-B-A-N-D, and they're on Twitter, at Saraband Books.
Now it's back to Sarah Morgan for the books of her life. Sarah, was there a book that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
That is such a hard question. Am I allowed more than one? I was a big reader as a child. I knew at the age of 8 that I wanted to be an author, but I don't remember it being a specific book. But I had so many favourites. So beginning with Winnie the Pooh, who I thought the characters were just wonderful. I still think that. And I think that they give out wonderful life advice. And for years, I had one stuck above my desk, the quote about, what if a tree falls down when we're standing underneath it? And Pooh says, what if it doesn't? And that's really a very good piece of advice for anxious people. I loved Black Beauty, Anna Sewell, because I was a big horse lover. I loved the Rudyard Kipling Just So stories. I suppose I liked animal stories, actually, now I think about it. I read a lot of horse fiction. and I read the classics. I loved Jane Eyre. I remember my mother giving me Jane Eyre and saying, try that. And I did absolutely love it. But there wasn't one specific book that made me want to write. I just wanted to write. I don't know where it came from. But I remember at 8 saying to my mother, I really want to be an author one day.
So if I had to ask you to select one for me to play a clip of in the show, which would it be?
One. Oh, no. I'd probably have one of Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories. Probably The Cat Who Walked by Himself.
Out in the wet, wild woods, all the wild animals gathered together where they could see the light of the fire a long way off, and they wondered what it meant. Then Wild Horse stamped with his wild foot and said, "Oh, my friends and oh, my enemies, why have the man and the woman made that great light in that great cave? And what harm will it do us?" Wild Dog lifted up his wild nose and smelled the smell of the roast mutton and said, "I will go up and see and look and say, for I think it is good. Cat, come with me."
"Nanny," said the cat, "I am the cat who walks by himself, and all places are alike to me. I will not come."
"Then we can never be friends again," said the wild dog, and he trotted off to the cave. But when he'd gone a little way, the cat said to himself, "All places are alike to me. Why should I not go too, and see, and look, and come away at my own liking?" So he slipped after the wild dog, softly, very softly, and hid himself where he could hear everything. When Wild Dog reached the mouth of the cave, he lifted up the dried horse skin with his nose and sniffed the beautiful smell of the roast mutton. And the woman, looking at the blade burn, heard him and laughed and said, "Here comes the first. Wild thing out of the wild woods, what do you want?"
The Cat Who Walked for Himself, from Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, is TB2336. It's narrated by Robin Holmes. Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Again, it's quite hard, but a real comfort read for me is a book called The Peach Keeper by Sarah Addison Allen, who is an American author, I believe. It was given to me by a friend, and I just love it. It's a really clever book. It's a little quirky, mystical thriller. It's a romance, but it's also friendship and, yeah, a thriller. A little bit of magical realism along the lines of Alice Hoffman and Practical Magic. I've read it several times, and I love the language, I love the setting, and the characters. It's a very clever book.
The day Paxton Osgood took the box of heavy stock foil-lined envelopes to the post office, the ones she'd had a professional calligrapher address, it began to rain so hard the air turned as white as bleached cotton. By nightfall, rivers had crested at flood stage, and for the first time since 1936, the mail couldn't be delivered. When things began to dry out, when basements were pumped free of water and branches were cleared from yards and streets, the invitations were finally delivered, but to all the wrong houses. Neighbors laughed over fences, handing the misdelivered pieces of mail to their rightful owners with comments about the crazy weather and their careless postman. The next day, an unusual number of people showed up at the doctor's office with infected paper cuts because the envelopes had sealed cement-like from the moisture. Later, the single-card invitations themselves seemed to hide and pop back up at random.
Mrs. Jameson's invitation disappeared for 2 days, then reappeared in a bird's nest outside. Harper Rowley's invitation was found in the church bell tower, Mr. Kingsley's in his elderly mother's garden shed. If anyone had been paying attention to the signs, they would have realized that air turns white when things are about to change, that paper cuts mean there's more to what's written on the page than meets the eye, and that birds are always out to protect you from things you don't see.
The Peach Keeper, written by Sarah Allen, is available commercially. It's narrated by Karen White.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Oh, yes. Well, at the moment, funnily enough, talking about audiobooks, I'm reading Marion Keyes' latest, Grown Ups. I'm listening to that in audio, and she's reading it herself. It's pure Marion Keyes, real combination of humour and serious topics, complicated relationships, hugely dysfunctional families. And it's great, but I love the fact that I think it has an extra boost that she's actually reading it herself and you hear her voice. So I'm enjoying it very much.
Bridie issued stern instructions to the younger kids that if their sorbets tasted in any way funny, they must desist from eating them with immediate effect. She actually said those words, desist and with immediate effect. It was at times such as these that Johnny Casey wondered at the wisdom of sending children to expensive schools. They created monsters. Jessie resumed her spot at the head of the table. Everyone okay? She asked. Cheerful noises of assent rose, because that was how things rolled in Jessie's world. But when the hubbub quietened down, Ed's wife Cara said, I have to say it, I'm bored out of my skull. Good-humoured chortles followed, and someone murmured, You're gas. I'm not joking. Several heads jerked up from their sorbets. All conversations ceased. I mean sorbets, Cara asked. How many more courses do we have to sit through? Couldn't we just have had a pizza?
Grown Ups, written and narrated by Marion Keyes, is TB25067.
Sarah Morgan, thank you so much for sharing your joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to all the wonderful readers who enjoy my books.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But we'll be back at the same time next week, or you can always download us as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. And if you can, rate, review, please leave us 5 stars or a nice kind word.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at Talking_Books.
Farewell until next week. Stay well, and don't forget to read on.